what we're doing is putting some thoughts on the tape this afternoon that I had written down in the past. I had thought of putting it on paper, but it would take quite a while, and it may be that we can get it fuller on tape. There will be more than one subject here, but I'm sure it's something that needs to be carefully considered by those of the church who are thinking deeply about the time in which we live and how soon there's going to be a change and what that change will be and what's going to be required of the Lord's people. We're going to start with a couple of verses from page 750 in the Book of Mormon. It's the second and third verses. It says here, "For behold, they rejected all the words of Ether, for he truly told them of all things from the beginning of man, and that after the waters had receded from off the face of this land, it became a choice land above all other lands, a chosen land of the Lord. Wherefore the Lord would have that all men should serve him who dwell upon the face thereof, and that was the place of the New Jerusalem, which should come down out of heaven, and the holy sanctuary of the Lord." And there are several things here that we want to notice in particular. There perhaps could be more picked from it, but we want to notice that it speaks of the land that we are living on today, for that matter. We won't go into all the details of proving this out, but it would be possible if we are called on to do so. But there is one thing that apparently the Lord had decided early in the history of this world, and that was that he was going to have a place for his own kingdom here on earth, a central place for it in the last days. And then he determined what kind of, shall we say, territory that should be. Now, when it says that this was a choice land, it means that it fit the bill, shall we say, in the language we use it today, for what he wanted. So he chose it, and we find that he chose it at the time when the waters were receding from off the land, or right after the flood. Now, it was going to be for a specific purpose. It was going to be for the place of the New Jerusalem, which should come down out of heaven, and the holy sanctuary of the Lord. Now, we will perhaps start with that last one first, the holy sanctuary of the Lord. We want to refrain from going into too much detail on any one of these. But we find in Hebrews, the 9th chapter and 1st verse, where it speaks of a sanctuary. And we want to just examine that a little bit. It says, "Then verily the first covenant had also ordinance of divine service and a worldly sanctuary." Now that couldn't be a holy sanctuary, could it? It was a worldly sanctuary. So that couldn't be the one that we are looking for. So we'll back over to chapter 8 and verses 1 to 4. "Now the things which you have spoken, this is the sum. We have such a high priest who is set on the right hand of the throne of the majesty in the heavens, a minister of the sanctuary and of the true tabernacle which the Lord pitched and not man. For every high priest is ordained to offer gifts and sacrifices, wherefore it is of necessity that this man have somewhat also to offer. For if he were on earth, he should not be a priest, seeing that there are priests that offer gifts according to the law." Now we want to ask ourselves the question, where did Christ offer his sacrifice? Was it in heaven or on earth? Was it for individuals, we'll say, in heaven, or individuals here on the earth? Now, we often hear that there is a sanctuary in heaven, but we would have to say that if there is a sanctuary in heaven, it would have to be heaven itself. Because when it comes right down to it, heaven is perfect in every detail. There couldn't be anything defile it in any way. Not since the devil was cast out of heaven has there been anything that was contrary to the Lord's will there. So it couldn't be a division there. That would make we speak of heaven as being where the glory of God is. If that would be true, then there would be one glory where God is and another glory down in what we call the sanctuary. And still the definition for sanctuary is holy of holies. So instead of stepping down here, we step up. But I don't believe there would be anything to back the sanctuary spoken of as being in heaven. Now we want to take a notice for one thing and see what the definition of a sanctuary is. It's a consecrated place. It's a holy of holies of temple at Jerusalem. It's the most sacred part, especially the vicinity of the altar of any religious building. It's a place of refuge or protection. Now, we believe that when it was speaking of the holy sanctuary of the Lord here, where we have just read, it means a place of refuge and protection for the Lord's people. Protection from worldly things that would destroy them. Spiritually, maybe, but physically at least. Let's go to Isaiah, the 4th chapter, and verses 5 and 6. It said that the Lord will create upon every dwelling place of Mount Zion, and upon her assemblies a cloud and smoke by day, and the shining of a flaming fire by night, or upon all the glory shall be a defense. And there shall be a tabernacle for a shadow in the daytime from the heat, and for a place of refuge, notice a refuge, and for a covert. Now that is not only a protection against anything here on earth, but that's a protection against anything that should be above them. Say like an airplane or anything like that. For a covert from storm and from rain. So, this would sound like it was speaking of a sanctuary, and it was called Zion here. Every dwelling place of Mount Zion, and upon her assemblies, shall be a shining of a flaming fire by night, and upon all the glory shall be a defense. Oh, I missed the one where a cloud of smoke by day and a shining of a flaming fire by night. For upon all the glory shall be a defense for the Lord's people, a place of refuge. We might follow this through a little farther. A covert is a place which covers and shelters, a defense. It is a place where it's guarding against attack, a keeping from harm or danger. Now it seems like the Lord has this determined from way back at the time when he brought in the different languages. He determined there was going to be a time when his people would have to be protected and not protected by the sword. Now, another thing concerning a sanctuary, we want to go to the 8th chapter of Daniel, and we're going to read just one verse there this time. Then I heard one saint speaking, and another saint said unto that certain saint which spake, how long shall be the vision concerning the daily sacrifice and the transgression of desolation, to give both the sanctuary and the host to be trodden underfoot? Now this shows us that there not only is going to be a sanctuary, but there's going to be a host in that sanctuary. Now, let's reason a little bit among ourselves. A host, as spoken of here, is one who receives or entertains another. Now, if the sanctuary would be in heaven, it would have to be the Lord who would be the host. And are we going to say that the Lord is ever going to be trodden underfoot? I believe your answer would be no. But the Lord has His own covenant people here on earth. And at the present time, I believe that they are trodden underfoot. And the place where His sanctuary is going to be is also trodden underfoot. Or it is controlled by world government. And that is not the Lord's will. And He is not going to go in there with a sword and redeem that to Himself, but He's going to use a process of His own that the world will know that it is He who is doing it. I want to read something here. We usually don't use anything from the Latter-day Revelation, but I want to use something at this time. It's a revelation that was given through James E. Yeates, May 1st, 1927, and I wanted to read just part of it. It says, "Verily, out of the broken fragments of my spiritual kingdom of the last days," and now we're in the latter days now, so this is speaking of something, this remnant that he's speaking of must be there to do the work of the Lord in the last days. Says, "I have preserved unto myself a remnant for the carrying forward of my work unto its final completeness." Nothing left to be done. "The people of the remnant of my church on the temple land, which has been consecrated to me, have not been wholly in accord with my will, neither do they at this day fashion all their works perfectly in me. But behold, for a wise purpose in me, your Lord and your Redeemer, I have held them in the hollow of my hand." Now, we want to touch this a little later on about not having everything perfect. Some resent the thought that there's imperfection in the church, but this says that there is, and I believe that we will find later on that the Scripture tells us the same thing. "Their priesthood and their ministry have been preserved in me, and their ministrations among men I will continue to bless, for they are an instrument of mine own choosing. Ye and my people of my ministry have questioned the spiritual call of those men of the ministry chosen to be apostles in this remnant of my heritage. Verily, if you'll hear my word today, I declare unto you, these are my chosen apostles of this present day dispensation." Now, the latter day, from that time on, he's meaning, see? "And through their ministry, if they continue humble and faithful, and through this chosen remnant of my broken heritage." Now you notice here that even though some of those who he had chosen and they were ordained at that time, if they fall, they would not continue on, but the remnant will continue on. And if it be his church here on earth, there would have to be 12 apostles in it, or the place for 12 apostles. "I will from this day forward and quicken their spiritual ministrations among the people, and will continue to use these servants of mine and this remnant to bear the message of life and salvation to the souls of men. In the midst of many trials, and despite the human weakness of my servants, who shall remain true to the trust given them." I want you to notice that, because we're going to go to Revelation following this to follow it up. "To the trust given them, I, the Lord, will carry forward my work in mine own time, and in mine own way, all shall at last be accomplished." Now, this tells us then that the Lord has in mind a place and a people that he is going to use in this. Now let's go over to Revelation, the 17th chapter. I think it's about verses 12 to 14. This brings a new thought into it here, or another thought. We ought to notice it. It said, "And the 10 horns which thou sawest are 10 kings which have not received no kingdom as yet, but receive power as kings 1 hour with the beast." Now, this is speaking of a time. Now, this was given, if I remember correctly, about the year 80-90. And The Roman Empire had been into being for quite a number of years, and just prior to this, we'd find that they were 10 kings at that time in the Roman Empire. But now here in a later dispensation of time, there's going to be 10 kings again. And they receive power as kings 1 hour with the beast. We're not going into the beast, but I believe most of you who will hear this will understand what it's speaking of. I'll give you my version of it right here. I believe it's speaking of what today is known as the common market. It had its beginning in Rome. There are 9 kingdoms today, and this is the last day of the year 1974. It says, "These have one mind and shall give their power and strength unto the beast. These shall make war with the Lamb, and the Lamb shall overcome them." Now, here's one thing we want to get into our minds, if perhaps we haven't before, but that is that the Lord is going to use instruments, the instrumentality of man, to do his work. But he will tell them what to do, and they are to obey his commandment to the strictest sense. It says, "These have one mind and shall give them, these shall make war with the Lamb, and the Lamb shall overcome them, for he is Lord of lords and King of kings. And they that are with him are called and chosen and faithful." Shows that they have been tried. Like the 11 that came through who were with Christ in his ministry. Every one of them were tried, but 11 proved faithful, one didn't. Now, I'm not saying that there's any that's going to prove unfaithful. I'm just showing that the Lord tries those out that he is going to use. And here it says they are called and chosen and faithful. And says they are with him. And we will touch on that phase of it a little farther along. I believe we will go over to Isaiah, the first chapter, and read a few verses there to go along with this remnant that was spoken of in the revelation I read and delivered through James E. Yates. Now this is the first chapter of Isaiah, verses 7 through 9. It says, "Your country is desolate, your cities are burned with fire, your land strangers devour it in your presence, and it is desolate as overthrown by strangers. And the daughter of Zion is left as a cottage in a vineyard, as a lodge in a garden of cucumbers, as a besieged city." Now we want to, before we get away from this, we will read this next one, and we're going to show from Ezekiel what it is that they had in, that there was, the Lord had in mind here when he said, "as a besieged city." He said, "Except the Lord of hosts had left us a very small remnant, we should have been as Sodom, and we should have been likened to Gomorrah." Now, Sodom and Gomorrah, you know, the Lord had to destroy because of their wickedness. But now, let's go back over here to Ezekiel, the 38th chapter, and read a few verses in it. I'm going to bring in another thought along with this. It's the 38th chapter. I'm going to start with the 14th verse. "Therefore, son of man, prophesy and say unto Gog." Gog is communist Russia today. "Thus saith the Lord God, in that day when my people of Israel dwell safely, shalt thou not know it?" Now here they are in the very center of a besieged country, and there's something there that has preserved their safety even with all this danger round about them. And Here is God knows it. He knows there is something there, and there's no doubt that he is going to try besieging that. But we know it'll fail. Thou shalt come from thy place out of the north parts, thou and many people with thee, all of them riding upon horses, a great company and a mighty army. Now, riding upon horses. Now, the horses, you know, were changed over to mobile units during the Second World War. Thou shalt come up against my people of Israel. And we're going to have to read here in a little bit to see what Israel is, won't we? Well, we'll probably bring it to our minds anyway. Thou shalt come up against my people of Israel. And over there in Isaiah, it said, as a besieged city. As a cloud be covered the land, it shall be in the latter days. Not like the last days, but in the latter days. And we're living in the latter days right now. And I will bring thee against my land. Now this is the land that we read about in the very beginning that the Lord chose because it was a choice land unto him. A choice land where he wanted to place his sanctuary and that holy city which would come down out of heaven from God. Says, I will bring thee against my land that the heathen may know me when I shall be sanctified in thee, O God, before their eyes. In other words, he's going to show his power in such a way that they'll see there's so much greater power than this God has that there'll be no getting around it. We'll go back. Oh, we had something here, didn't we? It said, my people Israel. Now, I don't believe all of the people of the Restoration are called Israel. I'll give you the reason why. Let's look back at the origin of that. It's in the 32nd chapter of Genesis. What I mean is the origin of the name Israel. Perhaps you are acquainted with it, some of you, and also acquainted with the history of Jacob, how he had to leave his country and go into another part of the world for his own safety. And he'd been away quite a number of years. Now he was on his way back, and the next day he was to meet his brother, the one he fled away from. And there's no doubt in my mind that that man was quite troubled in mind. Well, he sent the company on, he sent his family on, he stayed back all by himself. And I've had the belief that he stayed back there and prayed unto the Lord. Because he apparently had become a very religious man. Anyway, the angel of the Lord appeared to him. And they wrestled. They wrestled through the night. And it's commencing to break day, and the angel said, it's beginning to break day, or something similar to that, said, let me go. And Jacob said, I won't let you go until you give me a blessing. The angel said, what is your name? He said, Jacob. He said, thy name shall be called no more Jacob, but Israel. And when you read that, you'll find a colon right after the word Israel. That means that what follows that is going to give a definition of what was before. For as a prince is the son of a king. For as a prince thou hast power with God and with man and hath prevailed. And we find out that when Christ was here on earth, he gave power to those that believed on his name to become sons of God, to those that were born of the water and of the Spirit. But anyway, this shows us that will be a besieged city, but they won't be able to touch it. Now let's go back to Daniel, the 8th chapter, and we're going to get the 14th verse. Now, You know, we read a while ago, how long shall be the vision concerning the daily sacrifice and the transgression of desolation, to give both the sanctuary and the host to be trodden underfoot? And here comes the answer. And he said unto me, unto 2,300 days, then shall the sanctuary be cleansed. Now this gives us a period. Later on we're going to go over that again and see if we can determine the year that this is pointing to. I really believe it points to a beginning and an ending. But we want to notice here the word cleansed is past tense. It means when this date comes up, that sanctuary has already been cleansed. Now, if that be a heavenly sanctuary, there's something wrong with heaven, wouldn't that be? I know that's a poor way of putting it, but I believe that if it had to be cleansed, it would have to pertain to the earth rather than to heaven. And we want to find out how strong the cleansing is going to be, how thorough it's going to be. We're going to Isaiah, the 51st chapter, and verse 3. For the Lord shall comfort Zion. He will comfort all her waste places. He will make her a wilderness like Eden. Now, I believe we'll go into this later on, showing what the Lord has in mind to do to bring about this condition. And her desert like the garden of the Lord. In other words, the poorest place would just be caused to flourish as Eden. Joy and gladness shall be found therein, thanksgiving and the voice of melody. I really like that. There's many times. Well, I'll just read it to show you some. How beautiful. This is on the 52nd chapter and verses 7 and 8. It says, how beautiful upon the mountains are the feet of him that bring good tidings, that publisheth peace, that bringeth good tidings of good, that publisheth salvation, that saith unto Zion, thy God reigneth. Thy watchman shall lift up the voice. With the voice together shall they sing, for they shall see eye to eye when the Lord shall bring again Zion. And that's what's speaking of here. It's going to ring with the voice of melody, and it will be as Eden. Now we'll back up to the fourth chapter of Isaiah again, and use verses 3 and 4. It says, it shall come to pass that he that is left in Zion and he that remaineth in Jerusalem shall be called holy, even everyone that is written among the living in Jerusalem. When we read in Zechariah about what's going to happen to Jerusalem, we know that this has a strong meaning when it says those that are written among the living in Jerusalem. When the Lord shall have washed away the filth of the daughters of Zion, and shall have purged the blood of Jerusalem from the midst thereof by the spirit of judgment, and by the spirit of burning. Now here it gives us the understanding that will, this shall be called holy, a holy sanctuary. Let's back up here to Joel, the third chapter, and we're going to read a few verses. All right. This brings in another thought. Now we know the way things are going in the world today, that they just can't go much farther without a war breaking out, and that will eventually be the Third World War. It reminds you of somebody going down the road in an automobile, and every wheel on that automobile is loose, and they're driving it just as fast as they can. Now that's the way the world is going today. You know, if that was the case with an automobile, when one wheel went off, all four of them would follow suit. So, I believe that is soon to happen. And within a year or two, we're going to see this fulfilled that we're going to read about. Proclaim ye this among the Gentiles. Prepare war. Wake up the mighty men. Let all the men of war draw near. Let them come up. Beat your plowshares into swords, and your pruning hooks into spears. Let the weak say, I am strong. In other words, everybody that they possibly can, they're going to put into uniform when this time comes. Then speaking to the nations, it says, assemble yourselves and come, all ye heathen, and gather yourselves together round about. Thither cause the mighty ones to come down, O Lord. Let the heathen be wakened and come up to the valley of Jehoshaphat, for there will I sit to judge all the heathen round about. Now there's been quite a bit of speculation on that one statement about the valley of Jehoshaphat. There is a place in the land that they call Israel of today that they call the valley of Jehoshaphat. When you study it down close, you get to looking up the reason for it, and nobody seems to know the reason for it. Jehoshaphat was a king and a righteous king. And it seemed like an expression among the Israel of old was, when they referred to a place of righteousness, they referred to it as a place like unto Jehoshaphat or something like that. Anyway, using the word Jehoshaphat had brought into their mind the thought that there was righteousness where this gathering was to be. It was a place where there would be, in this case here, it'll be a place where eventually it will be redeemed by the Lord for His people, a place of choice, a chosen place of His. While it will be outside of where Zion will be at that time, it will still be a place that He has chosen for a work. And it says, come up to the valley of Jehoshaphat, for there will I sit to judge all the heathen round about. Now, He will again use the man as His instrument in bringing the leaders of these warring nations to that place. And it speaks about multitudes. Oh, we jumped one verse. We better go back to it. Put ye in the sickle, for the harvest is ripe. Now we will read about this again. Come get you down, for the press is full, the fats overflow, for their wickedness is great. You know, we often read about, as it were in the days of Noah, so shall it also be at the coming of the Son of Man. Or in Luke it says, in the days of the Son of Man, 17th chapter of Luke. But it's the time of the harvest. The harvest is when the grain is gathered in to be thrashed. And when it is thrashed is when it is separated, the grain from the chaff. It's in multitudes in the valley of decision. For the day of the Lord is near in the valley of decision. Now the day of the Lord is the last days or the time of the end. It's the day of the Lord. And we want to notice one thing here. And it says the sun and moon shall be darkened, and the stars shall withdraw their shining. Now, this is different than it says, speaks of after the tribulation of those days, you know. It speaks of this thing, similar thing, happening again. But let's back up to Isaiah, the 13th chapter. We're going to begin with the 9th verse. It says, "Behold, the day of the Lord cometh, cruel, both with wrath and fierce anger, to lay the land desolate, and he shall destroy the sinners thereof out of it. For the stars of heaven and the constellations thereof shall not give their light. The sun shall be darkened in his going forth, and the moon shall not cause her light to shine." Now I want to get another one on this. I want to go to Zechariah, the 14th chapter, and verses 6 and 7. Now, when we read the first verse, "Behold, the day of the Lord cometh, and thy spoils shall be divided in the midst of thee." Now, each time you see, it brings in the day of the Lord. "And it shall come to pass in that day that the light shall not be clear nor dark. But it shall be one day which shall be known to the Lord, not day nor night, but it shall come to pass that at evening time it shall be light." Showing that there's going to be a darkness all over the world. Now I believe it's mentioned in the 8th chapter of Revelation as well. Let's see what we can find there. 8th chapter, the 12th verse. "And the fourth angel sounded, and the third part of the sun was smitten." That would darken it, wouldn't it? "And a third part of the moon." If it was smitten, that would darken it. "And a third part of the stars." They also would be dark. "So as a third part of them was darkened, and the day shone not for a third part of it, and the night likewise." Now we put these all together to show that there's going to be a sign that can be seen by everybody all over the face of the earth, that this is the day of the Lord being ushered in. Now let's go back to Joel and see what the Lord is going to do. We're going to read verses 1 and 2. "For behold, in those days, and in that time, when I shall bring again the captivity of Judah and Jerusalem, I will also gather all nations, and will bring them down into the valley of Jehoshaphat, and will plead to them there for my people and for my heritage." Now he spoke of this as being his land. You find it in the 38th chapter of Ezekiel, and you also find it in the 2nd chapter of Joel. In the 18th verse of the 2nd chapter of Joel, says this, "Then will the Lord be jealous for his land and pity his people." Pity his people is because they had not brought themselves up to the standard they should be. But anyway, it says, "I will plead with them there for my people and for my heritage Israel, whom they have scattered among the nations and parted my land." Now it says he's going to plead with them. I want to give you a thought here. I believe everyone is acquainted with the time when the Lord pled with the Pharaoh of Egypt. He sent Moses up there to plead with him. Now, the Lord didn't do it himself, but he used Moses as his instrument. Now, we read here a little bit ago about they. It means more than one. They that are with him are called and chosen and faithful. And we went into that to show that the Lord had put them through the test, that it would be necessary for them so they could be used. But, you know, in the days of Moses, there were 11 different miracles or plagues. They really proved to be a plague for the Egyptians. But each time before one of those were put into effect against the Egyptians, the Lord had Moses tell them what would take place if they didn't obey what it was that he was requesting. You know, all the thing that he was requesting at that time was that they let his people go out into the wilderness 3 days that they might offer sacrifices to the Lord. And each time they were turned down for it. And finally, after that, the last one, which was the death of the firstborn, they were permitted to go. And then Pharaoh started to renege on it. Now, we didn't read all of this. Let's read the 16th and 17th verses of the third chapter of Joel. It says, "The Lord shall roar out of Zion and utter his voice from Jerusalem. And the heavens and earth shall shake, but the Lord will be the hope of his people." Now, you know, we read a little bit ago when the Lord's people Israel dwell safely. Shall Gog not know it? I'm putting that word Gog in. Says, shalt thou not know it? And here says that the Lord will be the hope of his people and the strength of the children of Israel. And we read the definition, if you remember, what Israel is. So shall you know that I am the Lord your God, dwelling in Zion, my holy mountain. Then shall Jerusalem be holy, and there shall be no strangers pass through her anymore. Now, we see here that the Lord is going to be dwelling in Zion, his holy mountain. In other words, when he's speaking of his mountain, he's speaking of his government here on earth. Now, a mountain is a high hill, or a large hill, or some similar definition. We find in Psalms, David is asking a question. Who are these that's going to ascend into the hill of the Lord? Or who shall stand in his holy place? Oh, Psalms 24, 3 and 4. He that hath clean hands and a pure heart, who hath not lifted up his soul unto vanity, nor sworn deceitfully. Now this tells us the ones that would be permitted to go into this place that is called Zion. Now, we have brought into being, or into thought, that the Lord's holy mountain is Zion. Now, we want to go to Isaiah. Isaiah, the 11th chapter, in verses 6 through 9. You know, this is something that the world cannot believe, because we lived in a condition in the world for so many centuries that something like is spoken of here would be impossible, they think. It says, "The wolf shall dwell with the lamb, and the leopard shall lie down with the kid, and the calf and the young lion and the fatling together, and a little child shall lead them. The cow and the bear shall feed, their young ones shall lie down together. The lion shall eat straw like the ox. The sucking child shall play on the hole of the asp. Then the weaned child shall put his hand on the cockatrice stand. They shall not hurt nor destroy in all my holy mountain, for the earth shall be full of the knowledge of the Lord as the waters cover the sea." Now we spoke a little bit ago about the Lord being sanctified in Gog. There's a knowledge will go out over the world after this war has taken place. But in this place that that Gog has found that the Lord's people are dwelling safely, these conditions will exist that we just read up here. Now, many times we think, well, now that can't be while the earth stands, while the world has control of the earth in any part, it couldn't be. And they say, well, it will have to be during the time of the millennium. Well, let's follow it on through then and see if that is correct. Now, it says up here in the 11th verse, now we just got through reading about a condition that's going to be here, and it says in the 11th verse, it shall come to pass that that day shall the Lord set his hand again to recover the people of... Shall the Lord set his hand again the second time to recover the remnant of his people, which shall be left from Assyria, from Egypt, from Pathros, from Cush, from Elam, from Shinar, from Hamath, and from the islands of the sea. Now at that time he's going to do that. Now let's go over to the Book of Mormon, page 188, and the third verse. That's the fourth chapter of Jacob. And in the day that he shall set his hand again the second time to recover his people is the day, even the last time, that the servants of the Lord shall go forth in his power to nourish and prune his vineyard, and after that the end soon cometh. So you see, it will not be during the millennium that we have to wait for, but these conditions will have their beginning even before the millennium is ushered in. They will even have their beginning in time for the servants of the Lord when they go out to be able to tell the people that this condition is being lived in Zion. Now, we want to go, Zion is a territory. And it's the territory where New Jerusalem will be built. And New Jerusalem will be the capital city of the Lord in the last days. Matthew, the fifth chapter and the 35th verse, will give us the definition of the name Jerusalem. I'm going to read the 34th and 35th. But I say unto you, swear not at all, neither by heaven, for it is God's throne, neither by the earth, for it is his footstool, neither by Jerusalem, for it is the city of the great king. Now when Christ was here on earth, instituting his church, building it, he used Jerusalem as his capital city at that time. That city has never been destroyed. It's still in existence and will be in existence right on through. But now when he returns, he's going to set up his kingdom, establish his kingdom in the Western Hemisphere. First it was in the Eastern Hemisphere. This time it'll be in the Western Hemisphere and will be in Joseph's land. And his capital city, again, will be Jerusalem, but it will be called New Jerusalem. Now, the thought comes into mind, we read it there in our reading to begin with, in page 750 in the third verse. It said it would come down out of heaven. Now, we want to show you that could not be built in heaven according to the scripture. We're going to call your attention to page 664 on the Book of Mormon and the second verse. It says there, and also as many of the house of Israel as shall come, that they may build a city which shall be called the New Jerusalem. Build. If you build construct a building or buildings, you start from the ground up. You lay the footing, the foundation, and put the substructure on and go ahead and build that building. Now, maybe you think that sounds like a conflict. We want to show an example that's given in the Book of Mormon by a couple of references. First, we want to go to page 53 and verse 70. It said, "It came to pass that the Lord spake unto me, saying, Thou shalt construct a ship after the manner which I will show thee, that I may carry thy people across these waters." Now, Nephi was to build that ship by the instructions that came down from God out of heaven. Now let's go over to 60 and see if that isn't true. Page 60, verses 169 through 172. "And the Lord did show me from time to time after the manner I should work the timbers of the ship." Now I, Nephi, did not work the timbers after the manner which was learned by man, neither did I build the ship after the manner of man. So you see, he couldn't have followed after patterns or designs that he might have had here on earth. "But I did build it after the manner which the Lord had shown unto me, wherefore it was not after the manner of man." And I believe New Jerusalem is going to be built the same way, not after the manner of man. "And I, Nephi, did go into the mount oft, and I did pray oft unto the Lord, wherefore the Lord showed unto me great things." We can see here, and that he would go as far as he could in the building of that ship, then he would go before the Lord and ask him what move to make next. What was his will in the building of that ship? Now, this here, New Jerusalem is going to be the city of the great king. He's going to design it. Let's go to Revelation, the third chapter and the 12th verse. "Him that overcometh will I make a pillar in the temple of my God, and he shall go no more out." Now there's something that we didn't mention that, and it might be later on that we'll bring it to your attention, about the apostles of the Lord when they go out to these different leaders of the armies. It's spoken of by the Lord himself, "They shall go in and out and find pastures." It says, "You shall go no more out, and I will write upon him the name of my God and the name of the city of my God, which is New Jerusalem, which cometh down out of heaven from my God, and I will write upon him my new name." Now this is another one showing that New Jerusalem is going to be here. It's going to come down from God out of heaven, not as a built city, but as the plans and detail for everything that's in that city. And here's the reason for it over here Psalms 132:12-14. It says, "If thy children will keep my covenant and my testimony, that I shall teach them, their children also shall sit upon my throne forever. For the Lord had chosen Zion, he had desired it for his habitation. This is my rest forever, here will I dwell, for I have desired it." And it shows that ahead of time, he not only had determined what the lay of land must be for the building of this city and for the territory round about it, but also for the buildings, for the layout of the city in its entirety. He desired it to be built according to his divine will. Now we're going to bring into a new thought. No, not a new thought, but a continuation of one that we have mentioned a few times. We spoke that we're living in the latter days. And we're not in the last days yet, because there are many things that have to take place. Now, on page 44 and verse 16 of the Book of Mormon, we'll find this. Now the thing which our Father meaneth concerning the grafting in of the natural branches through the fullness of the Gentiles is that in the latter days, when our seed shall have dwindled in unbelief, yea, for the space of many years, many generations, after the Messiah shall be manifest in body unto the children of men, then shall the fullness of the gospel of the Messiah come unto the Gentiles, and from the Gentiles unto the remnant of our seed. Now you say, well, what of that? And did you notice when that is, what that measures? It says, in the latter days, and there's a comma following that. Their seed had gone into a complete apostasy and be generation after generation after generation in that condition. But at the beginning of the latter days, then shall the fullness of the gospel of the Messiah come unto the Gentiles. And we find in the first verse of the 10th chapter, 3rd Nephi, that if the Gentiles would repent, that he would establish his church among them. He did that. Back in 1830, April 6, 1830, is the day it was recognized as a church, a general church. It fulfills what is said in Revelation, the 14th chapter, in verses 6 and 7. It says, and I saw another angel fly in the midst of heaven, having the everlasting gospel to preach to them that dwell on the earth, and unto every nation and kindred and tongue and people, saying with a loud voice, fear God and give glory to him, for the hour of his judgment has come, and worship him that made heaven and earth and sea and fountains of water. And you see, that gospel was to be preached to every nation, kindred, tongue, and people. That doesn't mean that just as quick as it's received, it goes out to the different nations and kindreds and tongues and people. But the Lord uses his own method of bringing this about. And man is so full of zeal sometimes that he wants to run ahead of the Lord and get out into the nations where the Lord hasn't determined that that should come yet. And he gets the thing all upset. We'll see a little bit later on how it can bring about disaster if it's allowed to go in this way. Now, let's go to Matthew, the 13th chapter, and verses 24 through 30. Says, another parable put he forth unto them, saying, the kingdom of heaven is likened unto a man which sowed good seed in his field. And while men slept, now to sleep is to be unaware of. Oh, I got that wrong. That's slumbering. To sleep is to not have knowledge of. And while men slept, they didn't have knowledge of what was going on. His enemy came and sowed tares among the wheat and went his way. But when the blade sprung up and brought forth fruit, then appeared the tares also. So the servants of the householder came and said unto him, sir, didst not thou sow good seed in thy field? From whence then hath it tares? And he said unto them, an enemy has done this. The servant said unto him, wilt thou that we go and gather them up? And he said, nay, lest while you gather up the tares, you root up also the wheat with them. Let both grow until the harvest. Remember we read a little bit ago over there in Joel that when they are going to be building up munitions of war is the time of the harvest. And in the time of the harvest, I will say to the reapers, gather ye together first the tares and bind them into bundles to burn them, but gather the wheat into my barn. Now, you know, many times people will recognize some of the things that have come in. Through the instrumentality of man, I believe that the enemy works through man as well as the Lord works through him. And someone else will see it and they want to get things straightened out, and they'll start in some movement to do so, and they usually cause quite a bit of damage. You know, so here he said unto them, nay, lest while you gather up the tares, you root up also the wheat with them. It's going to take something that is directed of the Lord, just exactly how to clear this up. Now, this is part of what we read about over there in the 14th verse of the 8th chapter, where it says that after 2,300 days, then shall the sanctuary be cleansed. It, like we said, it had been going through that cleansing process, and it had come up to this time here when it was cleansed. Past tense, it was clean. It was pure. Now let's go over to the 40 through 43. As therefore the tares are gathered and burned in the fire, so shall it be in the end of this world. The Son of Man shall send forth his angels. And while we're there, I want to call your attention to the second and third chapters of Revelation. The messages are directed to the seven angels of the churches of Asia. And if you read close, you'll find that every one of those angels that's spoken of there are men. They're pastors at the various churches there in Asia. But they have a work to do for the Lord, a special work in reality. And that's what this is speaking of here, because the Lord uses man as his instrument in bringing about the things that he wants accomplished. Said, the Son of Man shall send forth his angels. Remember when the Lord called his apostles and ordained them? He said, he sent them forth commanding them. And that's what it'll be here. He will, they said, they shall, the Son of Man shall send forth his angels, and he'll be commanding them, because they will gather out of his kingdom all things that offend and them that do iniquity. Now, they have to have the direction of the Lord to know exactly what to do in this case. So he'll be commanding them. And shall cast them into the furnace of fire, and there shall be wailing and gnashing of teeth. Then shall the righteous shine forth as the sun in the kingdom of our Father. So you see, the Lord has all of this planned way back there at the time when he built his kingdom here on, built his church here on earth. He had it planned just how it would be at the time of the harvest. And he wants man to follow his directions specifically. Not just in a casual manner, but in a very definite manner, follow his directions. Now we want to move on to this. Now we considered the sower and the seed that the Lord told them to wait. We considered the church being established among the Gentiles. The angel's message that the Lord is to be the one that is worshipped, and then the gospel is to be preached to every nation, kindred, and tongue, and people. And we also noticed in the Book of Mormon the length of the latter days. And that would be from the time that the Gentiles receive the gospel until the time that it goes to the American Indian in its purity. That would usher in the latter days at that time. So the gospel has to be purified, as we found out here in the reference and Matthew 41, where it said, "The Son of Man shall send forth his angels, and they shall gather out of his kingdom all things that offend, and them that do iniquity." The things that offend the Lord are false teachings. I don't care how minor it seems to be. If it is not absolutely correct, it's an offense to him. Now we want to look a little bit at our preparation. Then we'll get back eventually to the time when the sanctuary will have been cleansed. We're going to go to Isaiah, the 58th chapter, in verses 6 and 7. Says, "Is not this the fast that I have chosen, to loose the bands of wickedness, to undo the heavy burdens, and to let the oppressed go free, and that you break every yoke? Is it not to deal thy bread to the hungry, and that thou bring the poor that are cast out to thy house? And when thou seest the naked, thou coverest him, and that thou hide not thyself from thine own flesh." Now, I want to touch that last one in particular quite a little bit. What I mean, show what it really means. I want to go to Galatians, the 5th chapter. And verses 19 through 21. Now, this is meaning if these things are part of our makeup, the result will not be good. It says, "For the now the works of the flesh are manifest, which are these: adultery, fornication, uncleanness, lasciviousness, idolatry, witchcraft, hatred, variance, emulations, wrath, strife, seditions, heresies, envyings, murders, drunkenness, revelings, and such like, of which I tell you before, as I also told you in times past, that they which do such things shall not inherit the kingdom of God." We want to notice what that said, "and that thou hide not thyself from thine own flesh." In other words, it's the works of the flesh, they're talking about it, and we don't want to put up a false front that these things are not part of us if they in reality are. We want to go on with this a little farther, but we want to bring this to our attention. Now let's go read the rest of the chapter. Now it says, "If you don't do these things, then shall thy light break forth as the morning, and thine health shall spring forth speedily, and thy righteousness shall go before thee." Now that we know is a great possibility, because I don't care whether it's righteousness or unrighteousness, if we go from one place to another, our record goes before us. But if it's righteousness, then we'll be pleasing to the Lord. "The glory of the Lord shall be thy rearward. Then shalt thou call, and the Lord shall answer. Thou shalt cry, and he shall say, Here I am." Now, you know, many times we will pray over a thing, and it just seems like we can't get the answer. There is something, it seems like, standing between us and the Lord where he will not answer. But here it says, "Then thou shalt call, and the Lord will answer, shall answer. Thou shalt cry, and he shall say, Here I am. If I take away from the midst of thee the yoke." And now there's many times we'll try to put burdens on others that we ourselves would not bear. the putting forth of the finger, and that's accusation, whether it be right or wrong. It makes me think of what we find over there in Jude, that they couldn't say, rebuke the person themselves. They said, the Lord rebuke thee. Putting forth the finger and speaking vanity, if thou draw out thy soul to hunger and satisfy the afflicted soul, then shalt thou rise in obscurity, and thy darkness be as noonday. Where we might be noticed as we are today as part of the world, and just as people will say, well, it's just another one of the world. If we come out of the world and live separate from the world and its ways, then we'll come out of obscurity, and people will seek after our understanding. Thy darkness shall be as the noonday, and the Lord shall guide thee continually, and satisfy thy soul in drought, and make fat thy bones, and thou shalt be like a watered garden, and like a spring of water whose waters fail not. And thou shalt, and these that shall be of thee shall build the old waste places. Now, those are certainly going to have to be built up, because there's some are in very bad shape. I won't say too much on this, but some knowledge was given to me directly on that very thing. Thou shalt rise up the foundations of many generations. Thou shalt raise up the foundation of many generations, and thou shalt be called the repairer of the breach. Now, for instance, I don't know how many different organizations of the restoration there are, and there's a breach between all of them. Each one stands separate. There's no thought of seeking the Lord on these things. It just seems like each one has a purpose for being there, and the purpose is not of the Lord. Now it says, when thou shalt be called to repair the breach, then something has to happen within this organization to where every answer will be true. The restorer of the paths to dwell in. Let's, while we're thinking of this, go to the 6th chapter of Jeremiah. I hadn't thought of it right now. It says, thus saith the Lord, stand ye in the ways and see. This is Jeremiah 6:16. And ask for the old paths, where is the good way, and walk therein. You know, many times when the people are brought to a knowledge of the truth, they don't want to step away from the world and walk in the paths of truth. Says, walk, ask for the old paths, where is the good way, and walk therein, and ye shall find rest for your souls. Now, we want to notice here, in the fourth part of this, the Lord is speaking directly to his people. He said, ye, stand ye in the ways and see. Now, he makes a change in his address. He says, but they said, now, these are people that have either not come to the Lord or have turned away from him. But they said, we will not walk therein. Said, also I set watchmen over you, saying, hearken to the sound of the trumpet. Now, this means that the Lord is going to remove the cover that's mentioned there in the 29th chapter of Isaiah, where it says, the prophets and your rulers, the seers, hath he covered. Now that means that they're there, but he's not using them. He's going to use them, and that will be the sound of the trumpet. And I said, watchmen over you, saying, hearken to the sound of the trumpet. But they said, we will not hearken. Now, speaking of the church, says, I have set thee for a tower and a fortress among my people, that thou mayst know and try in their ways. Now, over in the 9th chapter of Isaiah, and the 7th verse, it says something like this. He will order it and establish it with judgment and justice. Let me get back to that and get it, because there's some things there that I don't know just the exact wording on. Of the increase of his government there shall be no end, upon the throne of David and upon his kingdom, to order it and to establish it with judgment and with justice from henceforth even forever. The zeal of the Lord of hosts shall perform this. Now the zeal of the Lord of hosts is the zeal that's in his people, zealous of good works. And you notice here, of the increase of his government and peace, there shall be no end. That has not happened yet. But that is future, and it shouldn't be too far in the future today. Says, if you will turn away thy foot from the Sabbath, if thou turn away thy foot from the Sabbath, from doing thy pleasure on my holy day. Now I believe he's pointing his finger at every one of us, that there are things that we do on the Sabbath that are not pleasing to the Lord. If I turn away thy foot from the Sabbath, from doing thy pleasure on my holy day, and call the Sabbath a delight. Don't go to church just because you think you should go, but go there because you want to. And the holy of the Lord, honorable. In other words, go there for the purpose, and a good purpose. And shalt honor him, not doing thine own ways, not finding thine own pleasure, nor speaking thine own words. How many times we go to church and hear a good sermon, and maybe the conversation before the congregation has left the church are on things pertaining to the world or their everyday life, speaking their own words. And many times they will go to church, oh, just religiously get there on Sunday morning. But when it gets about 11:45, they begin to watch the clock, because they've got something planned, something in line of pleasure for the afternoon.